Greetings.
Log Talk Radio.
Greetings. This is Sister Awareness, and today we will be discussing communities. This show will focus on the importance of the community and the role it plays in fostering competitive group politics and economics. It identifies three major elements that blacks need to transform their residential neighborhoods from geographical groupings into functional communities. I welcome the audience to engage into dialogue about rebuilding our communities, and also transforming them into a place that is welcoming and inviting for our generations to come. So callers, if you'd like to call in, the number is area code 347-202-0787. And this is my first time on the radio, and I'm hoping that we can initiate a dialogue, that we could do this every morning from 7 until 7:30. There's a lot of things that's going on that we need to change. Anyone who would like to chime in on the show, the number is area code 347-202-0787. And as I was saying, today's topic will be communities. And I will be drawing from Dr. Claude Anderson's book, Powernomics, The National Plan to Empower Black People. And I would just like to brief what he defines as a functional community. Okay. And in the book, he's saying the first thing that we must do is to convert residential neighborhoods into functioning communities that contain three key elements or operating systems. First, they should have an independent economy that is wholly owned by the residents of the community and provides consumer products, services, businesses, and employment opportunities. Second, they should have an active code of conduct and group accountability. And third, they should have a form of governance that collectively speaks for the residents and is capable of applying political pressure to outside groups. Okay? And he elaborates on each of the elements. The independent economy Not one black neighborhood in America has a black business economy upon which its members can depend to supply its residents with their daily necessities, products, services, or jobs. The civil rights movement of the 1960s was destructive to urban black communities in many aspects. Black Americans would have been much better off had the movement equipped blacks to do their own job and product producer rather than seeking the jobs of others and products of others. If blacks had become production-oriented rather than consumption-oriented, there is little likelihood that today they would have a hidden national unemployment rate of 34% and live in neighborhoods rather than communities. Today, black neighborhoods are totally dependent upon whites and other competing groups to supply the products, services, and employment needs of black neighborhoods. Code of conduct and group accountability. A code of conduct is a standard of behavior that outlines what is right and wrong within and outside of the community. It serves as a competitive tool that promotes group unity and accountability by suggesting either rewards or punishments for its members based upon how their acts help or hurt members of the group. The burden for establishing and enforcing a code of conduct typically falls upon the shoulders of the community's basic institutions, the church, family, and school. A code of conduct does several things for the community. First, as a system or collection of rules, it prescribes and justifies how blacks should think, see, and behave with other individuals and groups. These rules can be explicit or implicit, but either way, they act to govern individual behavior that affects a group. A black code of conduct is necessary to keep out the destructive behavior that is so often evident in black neighborhoods. Moreover, wealth and power can be built only where there is an enforceable code of conduct. A code of conduct defines inappropriate behavior and impedes it. It also rewards behaviors that uplift and strengthen the group. Any group that is characterized by self-hate, a lack of group self-interest, disorganization, and other social pathologies must implement a code of conduct in order to build an organized society and maintain an infrastructure that includes schools, healthcare systems, and other human services. Once a code of conduct has been articulated, it should be adopted and communicated through schools, neighborhoods, organizations, churches, and families so that it reaches all residents. It must not only become a guide to appropriate behavior, but also a guide towards accountability and the development of penalties for inappropriate behavior. So, if anyone would like to chime in, the number is area code 347-202-0787, so we can discuss some of the issues that we have in the communities and maybe come up with solutions how we can start rebuilding our communities and get those elements that we need to rebuild and restructure the communities. Also in this book, Powernomics, The National Plan to Empower Black America by Dr. Claude Anderson, he discusses empowering principles and practices. He discusses a lot about where our shortcomings as a people has landed us pretty much in the economic predicament that we're in. He has a chapter, Restructuring Schools for Group Competitiveness, that I would like to just brief, that I think is very important and that we should be aware of. He says, the traditional role of schools for black children must be changed in order to make them functional and relevant in the lives of black Americans. Black schools must empower black children by functioning as extensions of the family, teaching the realities of life, dispensing knowledge, and honing skills. It is from these collective school experiences that black children learn to perceive the world and their place in it as individuals as well as members of a race of people. Schools have yet to perform these tasks. Changing black schools into what they should be will require major restructuring. Restructuring black schools will require more than just tinkering with a few programs. We will need our schools to produce children who are appropriately trained to implement the Powernomics plan in our communities, in our economic development, politics, and in our churches. Clearly, it will be necessary to make changes in what and how our children are taught. The new instructional programs and proposed solutions must be based upon the realistic needs and socioeconomic problems of black children. If our problem is that our race inculcates values of individualism that hurt our people, then schools must design a solution to that problem. If our problem is that adults in our race feel successful only when they work in white corporations, then our schools must devise a solution and instill new values in the children. At the bottom line, we as black people must accept full responsibility for the quality of education our black children receive. There are few, if any, incentives for the majority society to operate black schools that prepare black children to compete in the economy. White society has a monopoly of control over the power of schools, and much of that power is hostile to our interests and opposed to our advancement. He goes on further to say, Dr. Carter G. Woodson said, in the miseducation of the Negro, blacks are the only group of people who take their most precious possession, their children, and ask their oppressors to educate them and mold and shape their minds. Today, blacks are totally dependent upon the majority society to prepare black children to compete with white children. White control of black schools presents a conflict of interest for the majority white society, whose primary interest is in its own children. As long as black people continue to wait on white society to educate their children, they will be waiting for a long time. Black America must educate its children through community-based partnerships between students, parents, teachers, churches, and businesses. The same building principles that were used in rebuilding our communities can be applied to schools, which are essential institutions and functional communities. Schools are also communities in and of themselves that should be built upon a strong sense of community, trust, cooperation, and group accountability. When teachers, children, and parents work together toward group goals, they naturally evolve into a community of interest that they control. The design elements for education in the Powernomics plan are very purposeful. The chapter describes how to apply Powernomic principles of ethno-aggregation and vertical integration into an education plan. This plan is intended to foster a love and respect for educational excellence and also provide a framework of self-discipline, a sense of community and racial pride. This framework places a premium on cooperation and harmony and is intended to foster strong and productive alliances between black families, schools, businesses, public offices, civic institutions, and churches as we recreate them through Powernomics. More importantly, Powernomics creates an educational process that is specifically tailored to correct the historical weaknesses of our schools by linking them to a national economic and political plan. And he goes on to say, describe what we actually need from its schools. Any plan to empower black America must have the involvement of black schools to prepare the human or intellectual capital that we need to carry out the plan. Under the right circumstances, education can empower an individual or a group by conveying knowledge, skills, values, attitudes, or culture. If we are going to effectively deal with the nation's structural inequality and the inappropriate behavior patterns of some blacks, then schools must accept the burden of producing the human capital we need to achieve these critical objectives. Otherwise, we will have the blind leading the blind. Nothing underscores racial inequality of power and wealth more than this nation's education system. The question is, how can schools that are underfunded and ill-equipped produce black children that are competitive with white children? We need an education model that meets and serves the specific needs of black children. The test of a model is whether it empowers blacks to compete in a political and economic marketplaces. Nothing more, nothing less. Empowering black children is more than teaching them math and reading skills. It is more than preparing them for public sector jobs or high-ranking position in other people's businesses, in other people's communities. They must know how to compete for wealth and power rather than poverty and acceptance, to produce rather than consume, and to be the job producers rather than the job seekers. For schools, preparing black America to compete means removing the chains of inappropriate behavior and teaching them to see, think, and behave anew. The classroom education must be relevant to the world outside of the school, and black children should learn more in classrooms than they do on streets. Black children need schools to teach them how to live a life and earn a living in an increasingly pluralistic and competitive world. Only when schools are able to perform these functions will they be able to close the learning gap between blacks and whites and other ethnic groups. We have 10 more minutes before the show will be ending. If anyone would like to call in, the number is area code 347-202-0787. That is 347-202-0787. And he also, Dr. Anderson also goes on to do take a look at the traditional role of schools. Horace Mann, the architect of the common school system, ignored the existence of slavery and racism and described public education as the great equalizer. Mann, persuaded by the nature of the times to envision schools as institutions for whites, he felt that schools for the less privileged would provide them opportunities for social and economic advancement. Blacks eventually got access to public schools, but their treatment by the educational enterprise which ignored their unique experiences and competitive needs, stands as a national disgrace. America's school system traditionally served as a major conduit for racism. It cooperated with social institutions to maintain the structural inequalities that predetermined black children's life chances. Today, schools have not fully committed themselves to providing black children a high-quality and relevant education. Instead, social scientists and politicians have devoted half of a century to charging blacks with inferior intelligence and poor educational values. Historical facts debunk these charges as well as the claim that schools fail black children. Education is supposed to reward citizens for academic achievement based on the rule that the more education you have, the more wealth and money you gain. However, when one tracks economic and educational progress, it reveals that there is practically no relationship between black people's level of wealth and income and their level of educational achievement. When we examine the educational accomplishment of blacks from the 1860s to the 1960s, we see some astounding accomplishments. It shows that in the early 1860s, approximately 98% of America's black population was illiterate by design. Following the Civil War, nearly 25 million European immigrants came to America with the same illiteracy rate as the black ex-slaves. Within 30 years between emancipation and the Plessy versus Ferguson decision of 1896, blacks cut their illiteracy in half, reducing it from 98% to 48%. Blacks reduced their illiteracy rate twice as fast as the European immigrants. However, as European immigrants achieved educationally, they moved up in wealth, income, political empowerment, social acceptance, and business ownership. Blacks were on the bottom and stayed on the bottom. There was no direct relationship between the astounding educational achievements and benefits. Blacks did not receive increases in income, upward mobility, or political empowerment in accord with their educational achievements. The reason for their lack of forward mobility is simple. Educational achievement by itself cannot override structural racism and make blacks politically and economically self-sufficient or competitive. This is true because education is a determiner of class, but does not transcend or eradicate racial boundaries for blacks. The spectacular educational accomplishments of blacks did not translate into the same economic benefits as they did for Jews and other European immigrants before and after World War I. Jewish immigrants were coming into the country with illiteracy rates equal to blacks, but since they were not black, they were accepted into the banking, clothing, entertainment, and jewelry industries and professions. As they were being accepted, a national racial backlash moved across the country in opposition to black people. In the South, members of the majority society burned black farmers' crops, poisoned their animals, poured kerosene on their farm crops, and lynched at least one black man per day. Their nearly impossible educational achievements did not change black status in terms of power, wealth, and upward mobility. Even as late as the 1950s, consensus data indicated that a white high school graduate earned more than a black college graduate. A black person earned only 54 cents for every dollar a white person earned. The largest number of blacks ever entered college and government service following the Black Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s. Blacks' earned income went as high as 67% for 67 cents for every dollar that whites earned in the mid-1970s before falling back down to 56 cents in the 1980s. Income has remained relatively unchanged. Nearly half a century after the Civil Rights Movement began, blacks' earned income is back to where it was in the 1950s. Education has yet to offer the same economic or wealth rewards to blacks that it does to whites. Since education was not designed to eradicate wealth and other inequalities between the races, were the descendants of slaves wrong in wanting an education? No, they were not wrong. It's just that education is not enough. The majority society knew this during Reconstruction when they elected to deny black ex-slaves 40 acres and a mule and give them a marginal education instead. Education is an empowerment tool only when it is used in the right sequence. Black people were given no choice but to focus on social and education rights rather than economic rights. In a capitalistic democracy, however, economic achievement and mobility must occur before a group attempts to open up channels of educational opportunities. The educational achievements will then engender a corresponding set of cultural values and a further appreciation for educational achievement. Education allows a group to consolidate and extend its economic gains in the marketplace. When Jewish immigrants began immigrating into this country in the latter part of the 19th century, they established an economic base. Fortunately, they entered the country with some skills that were needed in America's emerging industries. They were able to capture these industries based on cultural experiences and chance than on educational achievements. After succeeding in these industries, they used their acquired wealth, political clout, and social acceptance to enter and begin dominating education. If blacks are going to eliminate the myths about why they are not achieving, they must understand that structural racism forced black Americans to lift themselves in reverse by putting education and social goals before economics. Though blacks demonstrated spectacular educational achievement and a total willingness to be long-suffering, they could not translate those educational achievements into economic gains. So there you have it, people. We will try to meet again tomorrow morning at the same time and finish our discussion on communities. And we will be studying from the book Powernomics by Dr. Claude Anderson, The National Plan to Empower Black America. I think that this will be a relevant and educational topic for everyone. I welcome everyone to call in tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock. And I just want to say thank you for your time, and you all have a great day. And start your day off right. Bye-bye.